Now you talk about terror. What about for me? I've been terrorized all my day. All my day.
Israel, like all settler colonial projects, is built on lies. The lie that the land historically belongs to the colonizers. The lie that Palestinians have no national identity. The lie that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. The lie that a peaceful settlement is thwarted by the Palestinians rather than the apartheid Israeli state. This mendacity is especially prevalent when Israel carries out its murderous assaults against the Palestinians, including the current genocide in Gaza. The Hebrew word for this propaganda is hasbara, or explanation. Hasbara is a combination of agitprop, propaganda, and censorship. It is designed to ensure unity among the Jews in Israel and abroad, sustain the support of allies, especially the United States, discredit and delegitimize critics who are branded, even if they are Jewish, as anti-Semites, and control the narrative within the media and academia. Hasbara is designed to obscure and neutralize the gross violations of human rights and international law that defines Israel's occupation. The effort includes the maintenance of websites, social media accounts, and messages under false identities, as well as the manipulation of browser functions, search engines, algorithms, and other automated mechanisms to control what information is presented and what is obscured to internet users. Satellite organizations, including the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the Canary Mission, and CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, along with Hillel Houses, Jewish campus organizations, carry out often vicious, coordinated campaigns of character assassination against those who champion Palestinian rights and denounce the apartheid state. As much of the world recoils in revulsion over Israel's slaughter in Gaza, which includes carpet bombing, hundreds of dead and wounded, mostly civilians, a day, the weaponization of starvation and infectious diseases, Hasbara has gone into overdrive. Beheaded babies, mass rapes, group executions in a nursery, children hung from clotheslines, infants incinerated in ovens, pregnant women having their stomachs cut open and the fetus knifed in front of them and their other children, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA, as a hotbed of Hamas, and hospitals in Gaza that serve as Hamas command centers, all make them legitimate in the eyes of Israel targets. Most of the media, including the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, and The Intercept, have swallowed this propaganda and spat it back to their readers or viewers as fact. Only a handful of publications, Electronic Intifada, The Gray Zone, Mundo Weiss, and Al Jazeera, have doggedly exposed the lies spread by Israel's vast disinformation campaign, often forcing mainstream publications, including the New York Times, to retract or backpedal on their reporting. Joining me to discuss Israel's propaganda campaign is Ali Abunima, one of the founders of the Electronic Intifada. Ali, you have fought this machine for a very long time, and I would argue probably more successfully than perhaps anyone else. You have exposed the mendacity of most of these narratives, and we will talk a little later on about this supposed sexual assault. I think you, Electronic Intifada, is probably the first. But let's talk about the machine, how it works, and we have to be clear, you have also been a target of that machine.
Hi, Chris. I think we have been successful to the extent that I feel that more people than ever are aware that they're being lied to. And that's such a major part of the battle. I, I, Sadly, I can't say that we have stopped or deterred the mainstream media, so-called mainstream media, our corporate and governmental propaganda outlets, from running this propaganda. I would say that their propensity to spew Israeli propaganda is greater than ever. And it is now as rare as ever to see decent coverage, whether it's in the Washington Post or the New York Times or CNN or the BBC. I remember 25, 30 years ago, we used to point to the BBC as the counterpoint to the biased and propagandistic US media. I would say now the BBC is as bad as any, NPR is as bad as any. But I think what has changed is the growth of independent media and its reach, and the fact that the internet, as increasingly censored and controlled as it is, provides us with a means to reach people directly. And that means that these propaganda narratives may be more pervasive than ever, but I think they're more mistrusted and disdained than ever as well.
I want to talk about the tactic. So, like with, for instance, the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, just for an example. But this can go back to almost any incident that gets wide play internationally. They lie brazenly about what happened. They blame the killing of this Al Jazeera journalist, a Palestinian-American journalist, on the Palestinians. They released video footage of gunmen that they said were firing towards her. Then I believe it was Al-Haq or B'Tselem, one of these human rights organizations, exposed that the video was nowhere. It was taken at a place where she was not even present, et cetera. And then later on, finally, after a few months, the Israeli authorities conceded that she may have been shot by an Israeli soldier by accident. But by then, we've moved on to another story. And how does that? So they shape the narrative, and they have quite an effective ability to do it at the beginning. We see it now in Gaza repeatedly, including the killing of people who were going to get food from trucks in northern Gaza. The Israelis say that it was a stampede. It comes out later, but by then it doesn't have the same kind of effect.
So the tactic is to play into the propensity of the U.S. media. And I think this is what they teach in journalism schools. I've never been to a journalism school, which I think is where you go to learn how not to do journalism. But they play into the propensity of U.S. media to both sides everything. So U.S. media in general takes the approach, particularly with the question of Palestine, that you never place your credibility or your authority as a journalist anywhere in terms of saying the Israelis say this and the Palestinians say that, but the Palestinians are telling the truth because the evidence shows A, B, and C. That's what, to me, a journalist does, is that you say, well, this is what two potential parties are saying, but this is where the facts lead us. That's what journalism should be. The U.S. journalism, the furthest it will go is to say, the Israelis say this and the Palestinians say that. Well, who knows what the truth is? It's a mystery. We as journalists are completely unable to discern anything. And so the Israelis play into that so that when Shireen Abu Akleh is killed basically live on television, which is what happened, and when there are Palestinian and other eyewitnesses who give their accounts in the immediate aftermath live on television and say, we saw the Israeli soldiers over there firing at us, and then Shireen fell, and then we were injured and so on, and the Israelis kept firing. That is never credible to the U.S. media. So what the Israelis do is they immediately put out a counter-narrative, which, even if it's false, and even if the Israelis know it's false, and even if they know it will be found to be false in a day, in a week, in a month, in 3 months, it serves the immediate purpose of clouding the waters, of muddying the waters, so that all the headlines will immediately be Palestinian journalist dies in disputed circumstances. Job done, as far as the Israelis are concerned. They don't need to go further than that. And we saw that again so clearly in the context of this genocide in Gaza. If you remember early on when the Al Ahli hospital was bombed and dozens of people were killed there, hundreds of people were injured. And the Israelis put out this narrative, which was, let's say, never proven, to be generous, that it was an Islamic Jihad missile that fell and killed them. Even though, you know, investigators looked at the footage later and said it couldn't have been that missile. But the job was done. The Israelis had achieved what they wanted, which was that the State Department spokesperson, the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post could say, well, it's disputed. Who knows what happened? Well, okay, so that hospital is disputed, but what about the other two dozen hospitals that the Israelis didn't even deny they attacked? So that's the tactic again and again. It's to sow doubt where really there is no doubt if journalists were doing their jobs. But again, it's that they're exploiting that propensity of the US media to refuse to investigate, to refuse to take a position on where the evidence leads. And that's the greatest strength for the Israelis.
They have two other tactics. One, they saturate the news organizations in terms of there's a preponderance of Israeli spokespeople or people allied with Israel who are allowed to dominate the airwaves and the print. And the other thing they do, and you've been a victim of this, is they demonize Palestinians to essentially tarnish their credibility.
Well, Palestinians are deemed not to have any credibility. If you're a Palestinian, you're deemed to be unable to speak about Palestine because it's assumed that you're inherently biased and inherently would not tell the truth. And that's not their tactic in other cases. You know, we're told, oh, we have to listen to Ukrainians. They know best what's happening in Ukraine. They know what's best for Ukraine. We have to listen to Syrians, of course, as long as they're allied with US regime change efforts, and so on. But you never listen to Palestinians. That's the tactic. And in terms of the inclusion of Palestinian voices, I've never seen more exclusion, more of an iron wall against Palestinians being allowed to speak in so-called mainstream media. And just from my own experience, I can tell you that 20 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for me. You can go back and look at the archives. I would be invited onto CNN. I would be invited even onto Fox News, onto MSNBC, onto the BBC, onto NPR, onto CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. That happens now precisely never. I can't tell you the last time any mainstream outlet reached out to me. And it's not that I'm, uniquely qualified. There are lots of Palestinians qualified to speak, but I am one fairly well-known Palestinian journalist and writer who can speak about these issues, but they will never have me on. I get called regularly by Al Jazeera, regularly, although less frequently, by whether it's RT or TRT, the Turkish outlet, CGTN from China, and various independent outlets. That's who will call me, but never a mainstream outlet. Absolutely never. And that's not just me. I'm just using myself as an example. It's very rare to find Palestinians now in the mainstream media. If you do, they are usually, with no disrespect to them, there are some You know, there are always exceptions to every rule. I'm not saying you won't find great Palestinians speaking in the media. Of course, you will. But in general, it's the what they would consider the safest Palestinians or representatives of the Palestinian Authority who we can safely say do not represent Palestinians, even, you know, to the extent that we can rely on opinion polls. They are rejected by the vast majority of Palestinians. But that's who will be called by the mainstream media.
Or figures like Sheikh Yassin's son, who I think has become a Christian fundamentalist and will spew the kind of racism towards Palestinians and Hamas, which, of course, his father was a co-founder of, that the mainstream media wants to buttress.
Very, very fringe figures who cannot tell you anything about the experience or the perspectives of the vast majority of Palestinians and cannot give you a viewpoint that is in any way rooted in that experience and reality. But it tells you that if they're searching for those kinds of people, that they are not seeking to learn what Palestinians actually think and experience. They're seeking to shape for their audience what they should think about Palestinians.
Why do you think they shut you out? Because the time period that you mention is one where there's certainly within the public a greater understanding and sympathy for what the Palestinians are undergoing. And yet, over that, let's say, two-decade period, you've seen your voice completely silenced on the mainstream media. Why?
I think that has to do with the very narrow band of ideas that we're allowed to talk about in the mainstream media. And I don't think that that has to do just with me. I think it has to do with anyone, and particularly any Palestinian, who goes beyond those boundaries. You're not allowed to question or attack Zionism as a racist political ideology, which it is, of course. You're not allowed to question the idea that the so-called two-state solution is the, you know, only outcome that is permissible. You're frankly not allowed to speak the way the vast majority of Palestinians speak and think. You're only allowed to speak within these very narrow confines. So that's one element. The other element, I think, has to do with the general shift in the role of the media, where we've seen it, and I'm talking about in the so-called West, the United States and its satellites and vassals, the media has become a far more domesticated mouthpiece for the government. And we see that across the board. I mentioned the BBC earlier, which to me is one of the starkest and most shocking examples of that. I grew up listening to the BBC. What among my earliest memories is coming into my parents' bedroom and hearing the BBC on the radio that my dad would listen to every morning in English and in Arabic, because it was considered reliable, it was considered authoritative, it was considered independent of the government. And I can remember examples when I was growing up of that independence. For example, in the late 1980s, when the government of Margaret Thatcher in the UK banned the BBC from broadcasting the voices of senior members of Sinn Féin, the Irish political party that is associated with the IRA and the armed struggle against British rule. And the BBC defied that publicly by getting voice actors to dub the words of Sinn Féin spokespersons like Gerry Adams in defiance of the government. And I remember when the BBC would do programs like there was a Panorama episode called Death on the Rock, which exposed the shoot-to-kill orders of the Thatcher government to basically extrajudicially execute accused members of the IRA. You would never see the BBC doing those sorts of things today. And I'm not saying this to suggest that the BBC was a perfect media organization that did all the things that I would want. It wasn't. But there was a level of independence that is completely gone now. And you see that in its parroting of Russiagate propaganda, in its parroting of propaganda about Ukraine, in its extreme parroting of Israeli propaganda. And it has lost any sense of a journalistic independent mission. But what I'm saying about the BBC is also true about the CBC in Canada, which I hear a lot on satellite radio when I'm in my car, or NPR, or any other of the supposedly public media. And it's, of course, a very similar pattern with the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are the, you know, probably the most influential newspapers in the world and the agenda-setting newspapers of the world to a great extent. So it's also got to do with that general transformation of what's left of the media into really obedient government mouthpieces.
I would have to say, having worked at the New York Times for 15 years, unlike the BBC, they were always bad.
Right, yeah.
Let's talk about a couple of, so we have this genocide, which is being live streamed. It's a staggering death toll. Hundreds of people, almost all civilians, are being killed and wounded every day. I covered Sarajevo, and you know, that was 4 to 5 dead a day. It was no fun. I mean, it was awful. But juxtapose that with the scale of the slaughter, and then, of course, the weaponization of starvation and everything else. And the Israeli propaganda machine has gone into overdrive. And you've done some of the leading work in terms of exposing the lies. Let's just do two stories that I know the Electronic Intifada has exposed. Let's begin with the attack of October 7th. There are two narratives. The first one we'll talk about is the response of Israel. It's very clear now from the work that you've done, and some Israeli newspapers have actually done, that there was a gap, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours, where Israeli tanks and helicopters were shooting anything that moved, blowing up houses on kibbutzes where they thought Hamas gunmen had hostages, so they were all being killed. And then we can deal with the rape story, the infamous rape story that the New York Times is working very hard to try and, you know, kind of salvage some credibility from. But let's begin with that first narrative that you did a lot of work on.
We did, but what we did, it, you know, the Electronic Intifada and a couple of other independent publications, which you mentioned earlier, the Gray Zone and Mondo Weiss, to us it was immediately clear that the Israeli narrative made no sense. How could lightly armed gunmen coming across the border, we saw them coming across on motorbikes or on foot, and somewhere on paragliders, which was very dramatic, but they're carrying AK-47s, and maybe they're carrying a few grenades and possibly even a few rocket-propelled grenades. But when you looked at the pictures that were widely published of the devastation in some of these Israeli military bases and kibbutzes around Gaza, it didn't make sense. Whole streets of houses leveled. Smoldering rubble. You can't do that with an AK-47. So what happened? And then you look also at the pictures, again, widely published, of hundreds of vehicles just incinerated. Doesn't make sense. What happened? Well, very quickly, stories started to come out in the Israeli media within a few days. And the first big story we broke at the Electronic Intifada was the account of Yasmin Parat. She was a survivor of the violence that happened at Kibbutz Be'eri, which is one of the kibbutzes near the Gaza boundary fence. And the account she gave was broadcast in an interview on Israeli state radio in their morning show. So let's say roughly the equivalent of NPR's morning edition. This is a big platform, a big national platform in Israel. And she told the story that what happened was the Palestinians came in, they took people captive, but she said they treated us humanely. That was the word she used. They weren't violent towards people. They looked after them. I'm not saying it's a nice experience, but what she said is they looked after us, they reassured us, they told us we're just going to take you to Gaza and then you'll be released. And she said very clearly that there was no violence, there was no shooting until the Israeli army and Israeli forces showed up and started shooting. And that in the house where she was being held with 13 other people, 12 Israeli civilians and one Palestinian from East Jerusalem who had been a driver at that supernova rave, who was also brought there by the Palestinian fighters, everyone was killed except for her and one Israeli woman. And both of them, Yasmin Parat and the other Israeli woman, when they gave their accounts, they said it was an Israeli tank that opened fire and killed people, killed Israeli civilians. And there are other incidents like that. Then there was the revelation from the senior Israeli spokesperson that, the death toll was actually not 1,400 as initially claimed, it was 1,200. Why the change? Well, there were 200 bodies that were burned beyond recognition that we thought were Israelis, but turned out to be members of Hamas. Well, how does that happen? I mean, are you saying that if there are 200 burned bodies that you couldn't tell if they're Israeli or Palestinian, what does that mean? It means that you are firing at people indiscriminately or intentionally, but without regard as to whether they were Israeli or Palestinian. Then there was the Israeli police who revealed, a police source who revealed to Haaretz that at that supernova rave, where we're told that Hamas gunmen mercilessly murdered more than 300 people, that in fact, IDF helicopters opened fire and hit people. They didn't give a number as to how many were hit by the gunfire. And revelation after revelation in the Israeli press. And most of what we were doing, I'm not saying it's not hard work, because it is, we put in long hours, is simply translating accounts from the Israeli press, writing them up, providing the context, providing the evidence. Often these are interviews that are given in Israeli media, so we translate them and subtitle them and put them out. So, Chris, virtually all of the information we're providing is coming from Israeli sources. It's not the Electronic Intifada saying it. It's an interview from a survivor on Israeli state radio. Or it's an account given by an Israeli military officer to the military correspondent of Yediot Ahronot, one of Israel's largest circulation newspapers. But these accounts are completely excluded from the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post, the BBC, etc. FAIR, the media watchdog, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, actually put out a really good report just at the end of February, looking at how many times major U.S. media had mentioned these so-called friendly fire incidents and recorded them, reported on them. And it was almost nil. They found sort of two passing references, one in the New York Times and I think one very dismissive one in the Washington Post. But that doesn't happen by accident. I'm followed by a lot of journalists, including journalists from mainstream media. They see all these stories. They know this is happening. And all of these major newspapers and news bureaus monitor the Israeli press. So they see these stories as well. They're not missing them. somebody is making a decision not to report on them. And that, I can't fully explain that process, but that is clearly what's happening. It's not like the Electronic Intifada has some magic powers. We read the Israeli press like everyone else. And when we see these stories, we run them.
Well, we saw the leak of a CNN memo. Thompson, who used to be at the New York Times, they've laid down very strict guidelines as to what will be reported and what will not. And of course, they're filtering everything through the Jerusalem Bureau. Well, they call it second eyes. You've reported on this. We know that the gatekeepers are there and that they're at the top. They're at the top of MSNBC. They're at the top of CNN. And they're at the top of the New York Times. The lie of omission is still a lie. But that is probably the biggest lie, the lie of omission that is used by these institutions.
I think that's right. It's what you don't tell and what you don't say. I mean, what we talk about context often. You have to provide context for reporting. When you leave out context, that's omission. And you cannot really expect your readers to fully understand a story without providing the appropriate context and background and history, which is what they all don't want to do. You know, for them, history starts on October 7th, basically. And I think that they have stuck very closely. You know, the other element, and this goes, we're focusing on the media, but we can extend this to important organizations like the United Nations, which is supposedly neutral, supposedly international, supposedly meant to serve international law. And we saw this pattern right from the moment the events of October 7th started, where anything Israel said Palestinians did was immediately accepted by top UN officials. They condemned it as if there was no dispute as to what happened. Whereas anything Palestinians say Israel did, or anything that Israel is even caught on video doing, we're told, oh, well, this is very concerning. We call for an investigation. Why did nobody call for an investigation into Israel's claims on October 7th? Israel claimed that there were dozens of beheaded babies, but nobody saw any evidence. Why wasn't there a call for an investigation? And of course, we know that Israel absolutely refuses to cooperate with any UN investigation or any commission of inquiry. Chris, you know very well what happened to Iraq when they were accused falsely of failing to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors in the 1990s and early 2000s. Iraq got invaded and destroyed, and a million people killed, displaced, their lives ruined. Israel hasn't allowed an independent UN investigator or human rights researcher into the country in years. I don't remember the last time well. And each time the UN, each time Israel conducts one of its massacres in Gaza, going back to 2008, and there's an independent commission of inquiry appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, Israel refuses to cooperate with them or allow them in. But this isn't part of the discourse here in terms of what the perception that Israel is an open society and a democracy and that it investigates itself. Israel neither investigates itself nor allows anyone else to investigate it, and lies all the time, lies that are repeatedly exposed, and yet it's still given the benefit of the doubt by major organizations and media every single time.
There's no cost for that. I worked at the New York Times. It's careerism. You know what's going to get you, but most reporters at the New York Times are good careerists. There aren't any rules written on the wall. You know what's going to advance your career and what's going to hurt it. Reporters don't want to go there.
I don't know how people... I never wanted to be... I mean, Chris, I never wanted to be a journalist. I never set out to say, I'm going to be a journalist. I still don't think of myself even as a journalist. I'm just someone who wants the truth out. And so, you know, if I had a leak under my sink and I had no one who could come and fix it, I'd have to learn to be a plumber on the spot. That's how I think of journalism. It's that the truth needs to come out. And, you know, I mean, I don't think I'm a particularly special person, but honestly, if I went out to a restaurant and I felt that, for whatever reason, I felt that I hadn't given the staff a big enough tip, I'd lose sleep over it. But imagine that what I'm doing is costing people's lives or fueling a genocide, or that my silence fuels a genocide, or that my complicity with a false story fuels a genocide. I don't understand how people live with themselves. What kind of career is worth that kind of complicity?
Well,
I don't know.
It's Eliot, the hollow men and women.
How are there so many of them, though?
Well, because the dominant institutions, that's who they want. That's who gets promoted. I mean, that's why you have mediocrities running these institutions. I want to ask about the quote unquote sexual assault story. The New York Times ran this massive piece that you and the Gray Zone and Munda Weiss and just eviscerated. But here, on the one hand, we have the lie of omission about what Israel's complicity in killing many of their own, along with the Hamas fighters. And then we have the overt lie or fabrication of an atrocity story that didn't take place. So for people that haven't read it, explain what happened. And I mean, it's just, you couldn't make this stuff up. They hired an Israeli woman who'd worked in, I think, Air Force intelligence, who was a filmmaker, who'd never done journalism, and what, her partner's nephew. I mean, it's just Keystone Cop kind of journalism, if it wasn't so pernicious in its effect. Let's go through that story, because you've done fantastic work and really forced the New York Times to step back. And they were going to put that story on their podcast, and now they're not doing it. There was an internal revolt among reporters in the New York Times who are just sick of the incompetence. So go through it.
Yeah, we actually have to start before the New York Times story, because the New York Times story alleging a broad pattern of deliberate sexual violence on October 7th wasn't published until December 28th. But so that's actually quite late. We have to go back really to October 7th, because immediately after October 7th, there were these claims of rampant rape and sexual assault and violence. And there was so much going on that, you know, I was aware of these reports, but I didn't necessarily focus on them because, you know, there was so much else. But there was, you know, credit where it's due. There was one Twitter account. I actually went back and looked at this the other day. We don't know who they are. They're called Zei Squirrel, Z-E-I underscore Squirrel, that has done really important reporting on this just on their Twitter account. They have broken stories. They've done great analysis. That account was questioning the mass rape narrative as early as October 9th, if not earlier, and saying this doesn't make sense, this doesn't add up, this doesn't pass the sniff test. But really, from October 7th onwards, this story started to develop of mass rape, of brutal rape. And remember, this was in the context of other atrocity propaganda, the beheaded babies that never happened, the baby who was put in an oven that never happened, the pregnant woman whose belly was cut open and then the fetus was stabbed, that never happened. The stories of children tied together and burned, that never happened. This, and so on and so on. All of these stories, which were systematically debunked, again, sometimes by witnesses who are there, sometimes by the Israeli media, sometimes even by the Israeli army in some of these cases. They said, no, that didn't happen. Lies that were too big even for the Israeli army. And it was in that context that the rape stories were going. Once Israel began its genocide in Gaza in earnest, and the wave of sympathy in the official West and the official Western media started to wane, the Israelis realized we need to revive the sympathy that we had right at the beginning in the shock of October 7th. And this rape story was perfect for that in their mind, because if you're appealing to a Western progressive audience, it's ideal. It's the ideal narrative for, let's say, the Hillary Clinton voter, because the polls were showing that in the West in general, in the progressive West or the liberal West, the base of the Democratic Party and across Europe, there was utter revulsion at what Israel was doing. So you need a narrative that justifies or distracts from the propaganda and paints Palestinians as just utter beasts, worse than ISIS. That's what Israel said, that they were Hamas equals ISIS. So you need a narrative that fills that role. And the rape story was perfect for that, because also it meshes in with a couple of ideas. One is the sort of latent racism that has been drummed into people, that Arab men, brown men, black men, Muslim men are violent, sexual, uncontrollable racists, which is a very old trope that goes back to Jim Crow days in the United States, and was the idea that the justification or the pretext for many lynchings, for example, the idea that a black man is a danger to a white woman or a settler woman, and that women need to be protected from these brutes, is a very old idea in the history of American settler colonialism and racism. And then you tie into that this sort of progressive sensibility about believe women and me too. So, you know, anyone who questions this narrative can automatically be painted as a rape apologist and someone who doesn't believe women. The only problem is there were no women to believe. To this day, as we're speaking, not a single person has come forward and said, I was a victim of this. And not a single piece of solid evidence has been produced. The Israelis say that they have 100,000 or something in that order video clips from October 7th. And yet not one of them shows what you claim it was a pervasive and systematic campaign of mass rape. So the propaganda narrative about the mass rape was already falling apart in mid-November, and we did our first sort of long debunking video at the Electronic Intifada right at the beginning of December, when other stories, I think Mondo Weiss had already run a story as well. So by that point, it was well and truly debunked. And we thought, all right, that's it, it's done. And actually, they went silent for a while. We didn't see it being pushed as much, because they had previously rolled out Hillary Clinton to push the story. And she lied in this little video that was put on Twitter, where she said that Israeli women and girls have come forward to talk about what they witnessed and experienced in terms of sexual violence, which was never true. No Israeli woman or girl has come forward to say that they were that they experienced this kind of violence. The New York Times story that came out at the end of December was an effort to revive an already discredited narrative. I think that's important for people to understand. And Jeffrey Gettleman, who is their Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, teamed up with Anat Schwartz, who, as you mentioned, was advertised herself as a filmmaker, never had any experience doing this kind of reporting, and her partner's nephew, a recent Comp Lit grad called Adam Seller, who also had no history of this kind of reporting. He had, to the extent that he'd done any journalism at all, it was as a food blogger. And they put them on this massive, consequential story. These totally inexperienced people. And it later emerged, of course, that Anat Schwartz, in fact, it was the Twitter user, again, Zay Squirrel, who found Anat Schwartz's social media history that showed her extreme far-right and even genocidal views. But you worked at the New York Times. You know how hard it is, Chris, for people to get jobs at the New York Times. It's considered the pinnacle of American journalism. And people may work at 3, 4, 5 other outlets before they make it to the New York Times and before they make it to sort of any kind of senior or consequential position. And yet, these two people with zero journalistic background are put on this story. And Anat Schwartz, and the story fell apart immediately. I mean, it was published on December 28th. Immediately, independent outlets, including EI, tore it apart. We found so many holes in this story, so many discrepancies. Again, they didn't produce a single victim, living or dead, that was positively identified. Not a single person who came forward. And Anat Schwartz actually revealed in a podcast in Hebrew that the first step she did, which actually is good journalism if you think about it, is she called every single hospital, every single rape crisis center, every single institution in Israel that is charged with caring for victims of sexual assault. And they all said, no, not a single person has come forward, not one report of that. That should have alerted the New York Times and Pulitzer Prize winner Jeffrey Gettleman to say, wait, what's going on here? It should have alerted them that the only story here was of a hoax, of propaganda, of atrocity propaganda designed to justify and fuel genocide. And yet, when they found no evidence, instead of saying that, instead of saying, stop, let's reevaluate, let's look at what is really going on here, they decided, well, if there's no evidence, we'll have to come up with some. If there are no victims, we'll have to come up with some. And what did they do? The central character in this story of by Gettleman and company was a woman called Gal Abdush, who they claimed, they never said it outright, but they claimed that, well, she must have been raped. She was killed on October 7th. They say she must have been raped because there was this video that showed her body in a position that was suggestive that she could have been raped. No evidence, no forensic evidence, no other evidence. After they published this on December 28th, her own family, her own sister, came out and said, this is outrageous. The New York Times never told us that they were going to suggest that Gal Abdush was raped, that we've never been shown any evidence she was raped, and they manipulated and deceived us. That was the one person in the story who they positively identified as a possible victim of rape. And then they had two other alleged incidents of gang rapes on October 7th, in which no victims have been identified, no perpetrators have been identified, but they have four eyewitnesses, two for each. The first eyewitness was presented by Israeli police at a press conference, I think in October or early November. And she didn't even appear herself. It was just a video presented by Israeli police where she told this outlandish story where she said she had been hiding in a bush. She'd been shot. She'd been at that rave in the desert. And she saw a group of men get out of a van and gang rape a woman and then murder her. And then they gang raped and murdered five other women and they cut off their heads. And they were dancing around, prancing around with the heads of these women up above their heads as trophies. And it was such an outlandish story. And the obvious question is, well, okay, so this is a horrific story. But if it were true, there would be tons of physical evidence. You'd have, where are the headless bodies? Where are the heads, the severed heads? Where's all the blood? Where's all the DNA? How could all of this happen without leaving a trace? At no point in the Gettleman story or any of the other media stories that repeated this atrocity tale did anyone address the total absence of physical evidence. And then the New York Times, when they retold this already debunked story in the Gettleman piece, they said, oh, there was another eyewitness who said he was hiding in the ditch and he raised his head and he saw a gang rape. He raised his head once and yet he saw all this going on. Well, the problem is the same eyewitness had previously told Israeli media weeks before the New York Times story that he didn't see anything, that he'd been told by the other woman who claimed to see it what she saw, but that he didn't see it himself. And yet in the New York Times a few weeks later, he's presented as having seen it himself. So that's just an example of the fabrication, the scale of the fabrication and the fraud. And the other element, which is so important to mention here, is that virtually all these stories came from what have been generously identified in the press as first responders. And that plays into a sort of a cultural idea we have in the United States that perhaps was reinforced with 9/11, with all the firefighters who were killed on 9/11. That first responders are selfless, self-sacrificing people who are inherently credible. So if a first responder comes and tells you, I saw this, well, you're likely to believe them. Well, who are these people described as first responders in the New York Times and other media who reported these atrocity tales? Well, many of them were Israeli army personnel. So members of the regime perpetrating genocide. That's who their first responders were. Or they were members of this Jewish extremist organization called Zaka, which what it does is they go to crime scenes or scenes of violence and they pick up bodies and body parts to give them a Jewish burial. But this is an organization that, for one thing, was founded by a man accused of serial sexual assault. And when this came out, he actually committed, he died by suicide in 2021. But this organization, Zaka, its senior representatives have told so many lies since October 7th, including, for example, one person, Yossi Landau, who was interviewed in all kinds of media, told the atrocity story, since thoroughly debunked and denied, even by Israeli authorities, of the pregnant woman who had her belly sliced open and the fetus taken out and stabbed. He's on video, he's on television saying, I saw this with my own eyes, something that everyone agrees now, including Israeli authorities, never happened. And Zaka spread so many, they spread this story that in Kibbutz Be'eri, actually this came from one of the Israeli army medics who was cited in the New York Times, that he entered a bedroom in Kibbutz Be'eri and saw two teenage girls who, you know, this is graphic just for any viewers out there, who were murdered and who had been raped. They, you know, they were stripped of their clothes and they had semen on their backs. This never happened. The authorities in Kibbutz Be'eri have said categorically, this didn't happen. There were no sexual assaults in Kibbutz Be'eri. There were no two teenagers found in Kibbutz Be'eri who fit this description or in that location. The Intercept just did a story a few days ago as we're speaking that further conclusively showed that this never happened. But this story is a central feature of the New York Times Gettleman piece, which the New York Times is still insisting is good journalism.
Well, they may insist it's good journalism, but there's clearly restiveness among the staff that realizes that it's not good journalism. And it was supposed to go out on their podcast, and they've not put it out. It reminds me very much of the podcast The Caliphate, which was a hoax based on an imposter who said he was a member of ISIS and crucified people on crosses, kind of audio snuff porn or something. I think it speaks, one, to the decline of journalistic integrity. I don't know that when I was at the Times, they would have hired people with no journalism experience or people who were so partisan. Not that they did a particularly good job of covering the Palestinians, but also with a siloing of the media into, so each media entities now cater to a particular demographic. They're feeding their demographic what they already believe. They are contributing to the stereotypes that exist. I don't know that the Times has paid much of a price for Russiagate, for the caliphate, or even that it will pay much of a price for this. And I think that gets into
The Iraq War.
Or for the Iraq War. Yeah.
Right. And that's because, you know, in February, I think it was February, the time is difficult now, but a few weeks ago anyway, they had this event at Columbia University to focus on these claims of sexual violence. And it was headlined by Hillary Clinton, and Jeffrey Gettleman was there, and Sheryl Sandberg of Lean In fame, the former Facebook/Meta executive. And they had a panel of what I would call sort of minor academics. My sources at Columbia University told me that several academics who understood the propaganda purposes of this gathering refused to take part. But nonetheless, they had Hillary Clinton and they had Jeffrey Gettleman. And of course, it was a complete complete regurgitation of the atrocity propaganda. And Gettleman was brought on. And it was interesting because he was clearly aware of all the criticism and that his story had been debunked. But of course, he wasn't challenged on any of this by Sheryl Sandberg, who interviewed him. He was praised. He was told, you know, you're the best of the best and you did solid reporting and so on. But he was very aware that he was being observed closely by all the people who knew that this was a hoax, basically, or a fraud. And he said, you know, my job is not to gather evidence. Well, I won't say that what I did is evidence. It's more information, sharing stories. So he backed off it in that way, but as if to say, well, hey, I'm not, you know, don't blame me if what I publish is wrong. I'm just sharing stories. I don't have any responsibility to actually stand by what I publish. And it was really kind of a microcosm, that event, because it really showed how all, you know, you have Hillary Clinton, the warmongering war criminal. You have Sheryl Sandberg, the representative of Silicon Valley. And you have Jeffrey Gettleman, the representative of, can I call it the failing New York Times or the lying New York Times? And also you had the dean of the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia, who is a former Israeli intelligence officer. And they were all there to boost each other and scratch each other's back and to protect each other's lies. And I really think that that was a perfect microcosm of the world we live in. And then you had the students in the audience who protested and disrupted and did so very courageously and admirably, but they had no other avenue to participate. They were completely shut out. There was no Q&A with the public. There was no opportunity for them to participate in a meaningful way to challenge these lies or to confront Hillary Clinton or Jeffrey Gettleman, except through protest, except through literally shouting from the margins, shouting from the sidelines. And so that event for me, and of course, Columbia University, which hosted this event, represents to me all of the elite institutions, which, especially our elite universities, which proclaim that, oh, we are here to provide a venue for academic freedom and inquiry and free speech, and these are our sacred values, but are in fact really just venues for reproducing and reinforcing the values and interests of the ruling class. So to me, that event really captured perfectly. It was sort of a metaphor for the world we live in right now.
well, Columbia University, which has banned Jewish Voices for Peace and Students for Justice in Palestine.
And is engaged in intense repression of students and professors who speak out on this issue. And like other campuses, is engaging in a witch hunt under the banner of fighting alleged anti-Semitism, but it's really a witch hunt against supporters of Palestinian rights. And that's the pattern in the media as well. If you question these stories, if you do independent journalism, at best, you're a conspiracy theorist and a kook. At worst, you may even be an anti-Semite or a Holocaust denier, which is what the Washington Post actually called us and the Gray Zone and other independent outlets who did this up till now, unchallenged and uncontroverted reporting, both on October 7th and some of the other lies we've talked about.
Great. That was Ali Abunima, who with the Electronic Intifada keeps journalism alive. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granadino, Adam Coley, David Hebden, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrisedges.substack.com.